Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 6, 2012, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to have one of our all-time favorite guests joining us for her 10th appearance in our 10-year history. Janine Jackson from the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting will be joining us for the full hour to talk about her take and Fair's take on the news of the day and the news media. It should be a wonderful hour. But before we go to our guests, let's go to the final episode of Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Today is our last show. Unfortunately, Megan Tatey can't be with us today, but we thank Meg for her great work on the show. She has a wonderful ability to find compelling stories and present them in ways that are both educational and entertaining. It's been a pleasure to work with such a talented storyteller. When Candace and I first decided to take up the Media Minutes mantle from University of Illinois grad student John Anderson, we had no idea we were embarking on a 5-year journey. It's been a great ride. We've covered copyright issues, low-power FM radio, net neutrality, public media funding battles, and the state of journalism, and a whole lot more. One of my favorite interviews was with Dave Hughes, the Cursor Cowboy. He started one of the first computer bulletin boards in 1980. Using grants from the National Science Foundation, he hooked up poor rural areas from Montana to Mongolia to wireless internet. I called him upon his retirement in 2008 and asked him why local, state, and federal government agencies hadn't tried to help wire unserved areas.
The phone companies hate this. Free communications? Are you kidding? AT&T wants to take the money in. The idea that I can sit here and communicate free to somebody else is a direct threat to the service business of the phone companies.
Another highlight from 2008 was the Federal Communications Commission hearing in Boston on allegations that Comcast had been blocking internet traffic. I went to the hearing, microphone in hand. I expected some strong, opinionated comments on the apparent violation of net neutrality, but onlookers met me with blank stares and rehearsed answers.
Just trying to get more information.
I'm here because I'm interested in the topic.
How did you hear about it?
I heard about it through somebody. Person's downstairs.
How about net neutrality? Do you have any comment on that?
No.
How about Comcast blocking internet access to BizTorrent? Do you have any comments on that?
No. I'm here just to learn about Miro. Is that what it is?
Honestly, I'm just getting paid to hold somebody's seat. I don't even know what's going on.
It turned out Comcast had paid people to fill the seats to ensure that net neutrality advocates wouldn't be able to attend the hearing and participate in the public comment period. Comcast's scam made national headlines and provided more evidence of the need for internet freedom.
Media Minutes has involved, well, a whole lot of minutes. Since Stevie and I took on the show, we have produced exactly 1,250 of them. And the show's archives stretch all the way back to October of 2004. We've covered some serious issues on Media Minutes, like the journalist arrests at the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minnesota. Jason Barnett from The Uptake relayed his perspective on the police order to journalists to disperse.
Well, if you disperse when they tell you to, then you're not covering the story. The journalists really are supposed to stay there at that time.
Other episodes had a more lighthearted feel.
What is the scariest thing about the media?
I would say the scariest thing about the media would be all of the makeup that the anchors wear. You can't really tell what their expressions really are because There's just so much foundation going on.
Stevie and I are huge music fans, and some of my favorite episodes were those that allowed us to highlight tunes on the show. Most of those electronic music samples you heard between stories came from Brooklyn-based musician John Sheena. And then there's my all-time favorite, Stevie's own song to the FCC.
Hey, FCC. Hey, FCC. Why don't you listen to me? You let big media run amok. And now the rest of us are plumb out of luck.
Producing the show every week for the last 5 years has been a whole lot of fun for all of us here at Media Minutes. As the saying goes, this isn't goodbye forever, it's just goodbye for now. Media Minutes as it is today may be coming to a close, but there are no shortage of stories to tell, activities to highlight, and policy developments to examine. Keep an eye on freepress.net for future stories and our entire 8-year archive. And thank you for listening. Take us away, Herbie.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, where we're based. And we're lucky to have as our guest today a person I wanted to have on a few weeks ago, but we couldn't work out the schedule because this is our 10th anniversary year. And our third guest ever was today's guest. And she's been on the program another 9 times after that, including today. So this is her 10th appearance. She is Janine Jackson. She's the program director at Fairness in Accuracy and Reporting, one of the really great media critics of our generation, I might say, Janine, to date us now. Welcome to Media Matters.
Well, I'm a little scared after all of that, but it's a pleasure to be here, Bob, as always.
You know, I think, I haven't done the exact count, but I think you're vying for the honor of trailing only John Nichols as the most frequent guest in program history.
Well, I look forward to my T-shirt or my prize when
Maybe we'll get a mug or something at some point. You can certainly put it on your resume. I'm sure that'll really impress some people. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about FAIR first. I think most of our listeners probably are familiar with the organization, but some might not be. You've been with it now 20 years, my God. Talk a little bit about the organization, what it does, where people can learn about it, and what it's up to.
Well, I think now when you talk about a media watch group, it sounds like a normal sort of thing, kind of a plausible thing that people might be doing, spending their time consuming corporate big media and writing about it critically. But FAIR has been doing it since 1986, which is one of the things that sets us apart. The landscape was not then what it is today in terms of media criticism and media activism, as you well know. So yes, we are a media watch group. We have a print magazine called Extra. I also work on our radio show, which is called Counterspin. We send that around the country, a half-hour weekly show. And then the website, fair.org, which is the best place to get started learning about us. It has a lot of archived material, but it's also the home of the sort of activism component, our Action Alert Network, which is just what it sounds like, a sort of list of concerned media consumers who we send notes to about particular grievances or problems in the media and facilitate their communicating directly to media. But yeah, we're media critics. We're a small group. There are just 6 of us. And what we do basically is what everyone does: read the newspaper, listen to news radio, watch television, and then ask ourselves questions about what's missing from the story, who's missing from the story. Wait a minute, does the premise of the story make sense? and we talk about that, and we talk to other folks, critics, activists, researchers, who can fill us in and who can fill in the voids, if you will, in the mainstream news media, of which, unfortunately, there are many.
And if folks want to learn more about FAIR, they can just go to fairfair.org on the web, and that will be an entree to the whole world in front of you. You know, Janine, there's so much to talk about, and I know listeners are going to want to call in with their questions, getting your take on press coverage. And let's start with the war in Afghanistan, which was in the news this week as President Obama made a surprise visit there to announce that we won the war. And, you know, what is not just this specific moment, but if you could characterize, I know that FAIR has been watching the coverage of the war, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq closely. You know, how would you describe the nature of the coverage of the war in Afghanistan throughout its history, but right up to this week?
Well, it was ignored for a long time as coverage was focused on Iraq, and it always had a kind of air of the forgotten war, and also kind of was grandfathered in, if you will. There was, to the extent that there was critical coverage of the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan was kind of the justified invasion, you know, and I think it always sort of benefited both from not very much of a spotlight for a long time, and then from a sense of there being it being less clear what the criticism of the war entailed. We always heard from the beginning, for example, that this had something to do with liberating Afghan women and girls, and that sounded like a good thing. So I think in general, as we find overall, there was a kind of lack of focus very early on, and a lack of clarity about what the mission was and is. And this is what I find day to day. You know, I mean, some of what we see when we look at news media is not that it's very complicated or that it requires that one have a deep understanding of history. You can just look at the coverage itself. For example, the New York Times just this past week had a story that said that Obama's trip that you're talking about, his trip to Afghanistan, communicated something of vital importance to the Afghans, reassurance that the United States is not in an all-out scramble to get away. Well, all I have to do is read that sentence and I'm already confused, you know. I already have more questions than answers. I already am left wondering, who's telling me that the Afghans are concerned that the United States might leave? You know, because what I understand of public opinion polling in Afghanistan says that, in fact, they are not very much in support of the invasion and have not been from the beginning. So right here, reading our country's paper of record about the war in Afghanistan, you read these kind of platitudes and these things that are tossed off as kind of so true that we don't even need to explore them. And they're things that are really demanding of exploration, and that if we had media that really involved a debate, and in this case a debate in which one was allowed to view U.S. motives and actions critically, the coverage would look entirely different, and we would not be reading things like Afghans want to hear that the U.S. isn't in a scramble to get away. You know, as I say, right there on the face of it, I'm confused by that. So, I mean, my take on it is, unfortunately, my take on many things, a narrowness of sources and such a reliance on official sources that even when they don't quite add up, we just see them repeated again and again as I say, so true that we need not explore them. If you read foreign media, if you read alternative so-called media, you get something quite different than what we get from the media that unfortunately set the agenda.
What do you think would happen, Janine Jackson, if a reporter had covered President Obama's trip and speech in Afghanistan and just said, this is complete BS, this talk, effectively, and, you know, the United States is clearly, we all know this, getting its butt kicked. It can't possibly win. It's a boondoggle. And we're trying to find a way to sort of preserve our interests and get out of here, and it's just a complete fiasco. I mean, what would happen if a reporter filed that story, which basically is what off the record everyone tells you?
Well, not only is it what everyone tells you off the record, but that reporter would hear a tremendous echo from the overwhelming majority of the United States population. Mm. In other words, you would never guess it from watching the nightly news, but the U.S. public are for the United States coming quickly out of Afghanistan. And they don't require what pundits seem to always be saying, you know, well, what exactly is going to happen after? You know, what is our guarantee of exactly? People say, you know what, we just want our troops to come home. We just want people to come home, and we are concerned very much about what happens to Afghans. But since they don't want us there, we'd like to be concerned from over here, you know, and without being in the position of occupiers. So that reporter, although within the Beltway punditry they would be an outsider.
And I think that's the point I want to get at, because, I mean, that never happens.
No.
Then I want to know, what is it that makes it so that that never happens?
Well, you know, it's kind of the riding on the plane mentality. In order to get to the level of being that kind of inside the Beltway pundit that gets access, and that's what I'll say that one answer, which is what we often hear, in order to get continued access to these official sources, one has to drink the Kool-Aid to a certain extent. This is, I think, what reporters will tell you, and I think it has a tremendous amount of truth to it. You know, you do get yourself closed off and closed out when you are too critical and too, tough. In other words, you ask a question, and when the answer you get is evasive, you ask it again. Well, that's sort of not the done thing among this elite circle of reporters. I believe that, but I'll say something else, which is that I think that a number of these journalists who've been stewing in the soup for a long time, if you will, I think they have internalized this role. I think they see themselves as gatekeepers, in other words, as being on the side of the officials, deciding which parts of reality the U.S. public needs to know about, and helping decide, well, what's the official story that we should tell the public? How do we sell the public on the mission in Afghanistan? I'm afraid, that many elite journalists see that as their role, you know, much more than how do we truly give an unvarnished and kind of complete and inclusive vision of what's going on there.
You know, Jeanine Jackson, I had Michael Hastings on the show a couple months ago, and he was talking about the response in the book he wrote, The Operators, but also on the air, that he got when he did his expose in Rolling Stone of General McChrystal after spending quite a bit of time with him and his staff. And journalists were outraged, he said, in Washington with what he had done. Not that he had done bad reporting, but that he'd done good reporting, that he'd actually accurately reflected what was going on in the office of the leading general who's commanding the forces in Afghanistan. And it was like he had violated some sort of Sicilian code, that you don't talk about the actual, what's that, the truth.
You know, I think we have a popular understanding of journalists as all kind of rugged individualists, you know, going their own way and trying to independently dig up stories. And certainly such journalists exist and deserve all the credits that they get. But there is very much a lot of journalism happens, most journalism happens within institutions. And any of us who work within institutions know that there's just such a thing as a climate, you know, and you may do a story that is, by all rights, an excellent story, but that, you know, breaks a code, that, for example, quotes somebody who should not be off the record and who was not asked to be off the record, but who kind of hoped after the fact that maybe you might not reveal what they said, you know. You know, those kinds of codes are not granting anonymity when a source asks you for it, you know, that sort of thing. A journalist can find themselves kind of out in the cold within an institution, as Hastings is telling you that he did, where you would think, and we as news consumers would think, that kind of journalist would be, people would be buying them drinks all around. That's not necessarily how it goes. And particularly, I think, as you get higher up into the echelons of corporate media.
Our guest today, Jeanine Jackson, the program director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. You can find out about them at fair.org. She's also a producer, a producer of Counterspin, FAIR's weekly radio program, which airs on our sister station, WEFT, here in Champaign-Urbana, Mondays, 5:30 to 6. If you want to call in with a question or a comment for Jeanine Jackson, the lines are open at 333-9455. That's area code 217, of course, 333-9455. And also the toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Janine, you've been at this for a long time, as have I. We've known each other for almost 20 years now. Certainly, I think we met 94, 95 in that period. And, you know, since you and I started, I remember, in fact, you and I were at a conference once in L.A., and it was just when Fox News was going on the air. This was in the mid-90s. And it was sort of interesting at the time, obviously, what was going on. What's your take on Fox News and how it's changed the news media environment or contributed to changing the news media environment in the United States?
Well, I think it's had, I think it has very effectively done that. You know, I mean, I still, to this day, I'm amazed not at what Fox does, which is very bold and direct. And I think, you know, if you just watch it for a little bit, you find it very unapologetically what it is, right-wing and also kind of salaciously. So I'm thinking recently about Steve Doocy, the head of the host of Fox and Friends, who just quite comfortably changed a quote that Barack Obama had made when he said, "I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth." And Doocy told Fox viewers that he'd said, "Unlike some people, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth," and this was picked up as, well, it was presented as a very uncivil swipe at Mitt Romney, and not just at Mitt Romney, but again, Obama, and by extension, Democrats, being anti what makes America great, and anti-achievement, and anti-rich people, and these are all very popular narratives at Fox. What was interesting and unsurprising at Fox, and the fact that they would be arrived at through doctoring a quote, you know, inaccuracy, also unsurprising for Fox. That's what they do. But what was interesting about that episode and why I choose it as kind of emblematic of their impact is, you know, the Washington Post picked up that quote, not just the New York Post, unsurprisingly, but the Washington Post also had a story about that was based on that quote that Obama had made a swipe at Romney with this silver spoon comment, you know. So are they watching Fox News to get themes for their story? You know, the New York Times and some other papers, while they didn't use the exact Steve Doocy quote, they also had this theme that came from, you know, that moment of saying Obama making a silver spoon comment, which he's been making is the standard rhetoric since he's been talking about for years. But spinning that story in that way, turning a little nothing, really a nothing, into another sort of partisan, bickering, low-level, silly, but mean, that's been Fox's impact on the landscape, I think.
You know, Janine, it seems, as you say that, the striking difference between Fox and any other news medium, at least broadcast news medium, is that it really sets the debate for what all the other stations talk about.
Absolutely.
None of the other stations, you know, Fox never cares what happens on CNN or MSNBC. But my God, MSNBC is, you know, obsessed with Fox.
Yes, it's true. It's true. And it really, I think it, in a way, to many of our listeners, it's kind of like, why are you even talking about Fox? I don't even watch it. And you know, I do my best to avoid it as well. But I think what we're trying to get at is, it almost doesn't matter if you or I don't watch it. So many people watch it and are influenced by it, and it has had the effect of pulling the whole discourse to the right, to, I think, a demonstrable degree. And I'm not anyone who believed that things were any great shakes before Fox in terms of real vital debate involving a real left against a real right. But I do think the way other networks look over their shoulder at Fox, and the way that even the, you know, papers of record seem to, on one level or another, absorb their memes and absorb their story ideas and their tone from Fox to some degree, I think is truly, truly lamentable.
Speaking of Fox, Rupert Murdoch, the main shareholder and the guy who basically runs News Corporation, which owns Fox, who is an American citizen, among other countries. And he, just this week in Britain, was chastised by a parliamentary report as being unfit for leadership of a major corporation. And, you know, calling to question whether he should be allowed to have licenses, which will now be considered for satellite broadcasting in the UK. And I was wondering if you followed that story and if you think that will be of any interest to the authorities in the United States.
I don't think it will, but I think that more's the pity. You know, as you and I know, we have this kind of pretense that licenses are rented and that owners of licenses who have, after all, this incredibly powerful gift of being able to control the public airwaves and put anything out there that they choose to and also make money hand over fist with advertising. And the idea is, well, you have to be in good standing. You at least can't be a felon, you know. You at least have to be a good standing citizen, and you're supposed to use it in the public interest. Well, that's a very hollow kind of statute as we have it now. And I do think it's troubling that someone can be in so much legal problem. And we talked about this with General Electric, which has its own sort of felony convictions and crimes as a corporation. You know, there are a number of license owners that if we really consider seriously whether we would consider them citizens in good standing, or what about have they paid their back taxes? You know, the answer would be no, and there would be an actual challenge to their licenses. And think what kind of, you know, all these people who believe in the creative destruction of capitalism, think what turnover there could be in these licenses if people really did ever lose them or ever believe that they were actually in any real danger of losing them. But as we know, the FCC has only removed, I think, two or three, you know, taken away licenses over the years. So
they've never taken one away from a profitable company. They take it away from guys who are drunk or an alcoholic that's going out of business.
There you go. So it really is something that companies don't have to worry about. And I think we ought to question that, just as we're questioning with CEOs of any kind of corporation. What kind of a series of bad and harmful decisions are you allowed to make and continue to make this, continue to run this incredibly profitable corporation and make money from it? I think Murdoch's license, ability to hold a license, ought to be challenged. I have not any hope that it actually will be.
Our guest, Janine Jackson from FAIR, Fairness in Action Reporting, where she's program director. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our phone lines are open today. It's a live show. 217-333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Last fall, Janine Jackson, the Occupy movement exploded, both in your home of New York, but across the country, following, of course, earlier in the year, massive public demonstrations, particularly in Wisconsin, but really in a number of states. And what was striking to me, and I think to you, I suspect, and certainly to a lot of Americans, was how it got relatively generous coverage, especially the Occupy movement, compared to what one might have anticipated. And I wonder if you give me your take on that, and then how the coverage stacks up more recently with the renewal of protest activities in the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know, Bob, we actually had we have a number of fantastic interns that come through FAIR and work with us and help us, and a number of them, unsurprisingly, have had some involvement with Occupy and with other kinds of activism here in New York. And one, our intern, John Neffel, who was an activist with Occupy, just did a little research for us that gets to the points that you're talking about. I mean, yes, I was surprised, although we did get the initial kind of let's hope it goes away, and we did get the initial dismissive coverage. We did see that Occupy was able to force journalists to cover not just the color of their hair and their piercings, but eventually, with just stick-to-itiveness and intelligence of strategy, to get them to cover the actual issues that they were talking about, issues of corporate greed and income inequality. And John Neffel, our intern, just did a little research and found that to the extent that elite media, that big media, were covering the Occupy Wall Street movement, they were talking about income inequality. And to the extent that they ceased to cover, as Occupy got a little quieter, When fall came around, as they ceased to cover Occupy, they ceased to cover those issues. In other words, it seems as though it was only activists in the street that were forcing these kinds of issues onto corporate media's agenda, which I think is extremely telling, both about the way media work, but also about the many levels of success of activism like Occupy.
You know, what's interesting along those lines is that one of the things, and I haven't done detailed research in this, it'll be a great study for someone who does, but I think one of the striking developments from my youth, from say the late 60s and early 70s to 2011, was that increasingly protest movements, demonstrations, were no longer covered by the press. They got less and less coverage, no matter how large they were. For example, the demonstrations prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq were some of the largest demonstrations in American history, but barely got coverage in our news media, just passing mention. And so it seemed like it was almost impossible to break this impenetrable wall through popular protest, but somehow Occupy did get through.
And what I think is great about Occupy is I don't think they care. You know, I mean, I do think it matters, of course, to get big media coverage, but what has so impressed me about Occupy is the way they just work around corporate media. They work around reporters who aren't interested in them. And when elite journalists try to kind of co-opt the story, there was a little moment at which I remember a New York Times story saying, "Remember Occupy, you know, remember when we were all thinking about that? Well, now it's kind of died down, you know." And, you know, you don't get to say when it's died down. You don't get to determine, Mr. New York Times,
done that with economic inequality.
Exactly, and we're moving on. And what I love about the activists of Occupy is they have their own schedule, they have their own agenda, and they don't work especially to curry favor with reporters, and to they're very willing to work with them, but I don't get the feeling that they lose sleep when they get coverage that's critical, because they've expected that. They're very aware of the way that news media work, and they're very much about getting individuals to find other ways of informing themselves rather than relying on a corporate media, which is of course very much of a piece with what FAIR has always been trying to do.
Janine, one other bit of business I want to talk with you about is MSNBC, which has also emerged now in the last 8 or 9 years as sort of the liberal station of cable television news. You know, what's your take on it? What are its strengths? What are its limitations? Does FAIR watch it and monitor its content like you do the other media?
We absolutely do, and I wish, at this moment, I wish I could turn into Peter Hart, my colleague, who I know is a much more careful cable watcher than I am. I think MSNBC has been kind of struggling all along, I think, to some extent. I have always wanted them, and folks have wanted them, to not care about Fox, you know, to not try to match other outlets, to really stake out a kind of different position. And I think with shows like Melissa Harris Perry, the new show, I think they really do seem to be kind of accepting that some of their political shows will be liberal, will be tarred as liberal, and that's okay, you know. But I don't really see them as having a very clear political agenda or awareness. They seem a little bit all over the map to me, and I think, you know, that's that ratings race, you know, that affects everyone, and the cable news cycle that won't allow you to be meditative, you know, that won't allow folks to slow down, that makes everything a sort of shout fest. I think they fall prey to that too, unfortunately. But we certainly do keep an eye on them, and they do have some new shows that are piquing interest, I think, around, and that are adding something to the landscape that wasn't so much there before.
What do you make of the argument, Janine, that MSNBC is just the sort of left-wing opposite of Fox News, that it's just sort of a rabid partisan organ for the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, if only, I would almost say, you know, except not for the Democratic Party. I don't think there's any way that anything is to the left to the way that Fox is to the right. I think what you see on MSNBC is just a little more, you know, someone may have a pro-union perspective. You may find more people of color on some shows. You know, we're not really talking about a coherent left-wing agenda, I think, that you see across the board throughout MSNBC shows in the same way that you see on Fox, not by a long shot. Just, in fact, you see many of the flaws and foibles that we see all over the place. I think you just see a few shows that are what you might call liberal, and that's just adding something to the landscape. You know, I don't really see it as playing a sort of opposite role, and to the extent that it did, you know, I would encourage at least a variety across the dial if you're not going to get it within networks.
Janine Jackson, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Janine Jackson is the program director of Fairness in Action Reporting, fair.org, publishers of Extra, the radio program Counterspin, which can be heard on our sister station, WEFT, every Mondays from 5:30 to 6. The phone lines are open if you have questions or comments for Janine Jackson at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Janine, one of the great stories in politics over the last 2 years has been the post-Citizens United world in which there's been this vast increase in the amount of money being spent on campaigns, much of it being filtered through what are called super PACs, which are shadowy, semi-anonymous, unaccountable, and unregulated groups that can place advertising on behalf of candidates. And I was wondering, as you and the people at FAIR have been following the presidential race this year, as most Americans have to some extent, how the news media is doing, what sort of job they're doing sort of ferreting through this thicket of money in sort of elevating the issues that are of concern to voters and making those prominent.
Well, you know, we're just starting to dig into that ourselves as election season, really goes forward, but I haven't seen anything to encourage me in terms of just the simplest thing of media looking at the involvement of money close to home. You know, the FCC has just said that that outlets need to make clear what kind of money they're taking in, broadcast outlets, in the form of money for political advertising. And boy, broadcasters are very anti-transparency.
Well, let me back you up on that if I can, Jenny, because some of our listeners might not be familiar with that story. Can you just give the backstory there?
The FCC wants to make it easier. They've been trying to do this since before Citizens United, but it makes it all the more important to make it clear who's buying all those television ads you see. In fact, many people see more TV ads about candidates and about an election than they actually see news reports. Well,
I think you can change that verb or noun from many to everyone. It's actually physically impossible to see more news reports than ads.
I think you're absolutely right about that, and I think there's some research in Columbia Journalism Review to just that point right now. Well, the FCC wanted broadcast outlets have to, by law, keep a record of who, what candidates or what entities are paying them money and to are buying ads and how much are they paying for them. But they have to keep them in paper records somewhere in the outlet. So if a reporter actually wanted to know where are they getting this money from, and it's important, of course, because, you know, when we talk about closeness between broadcast outlets and political candidates and politicians, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about billions with a B of dollars in advertising money every election season. And this is clearly something that promotes a closeness between politicians and outlets that citizens have every right to know about. So the FCC said it's not enough to keep them on paper. We want to have some online location where any citizen can go and look up who's buying these ads that they're seeing. And in terms of how are journalists doing following the money, well, that's not money that they're very interested to follow. Certainly some individual journalists are writing about it, but the outlets, all the big heavy hitter outlets, have been lobbying very strongly at the FCC to not have to make this information accessible, to not make it available. And that kind of shows you where they are on following at least these billions of dollars of money that are affecting the election.
What about the way the economy is being covered in our news media as a campaign issue or in general, but issues of how the United States deals with the stagnation and possible double dip recession, but certainly slow growth any way you measure it?
Well, I think the thing that sort of leaps to my mind about that is the seriousness with which somebody like Paul Ryan, you know, who says, you know, more cuts, more tax cuts and spending cuts, and that this, which no real economist would get behind as a way to get out of a recession, and which relies on kind of, you know, the money will come from somewhere. You know, any journalist who has looked at it carefully has said that Ryan's budget, you know, has some kind of magical thinking in it. But how seriously, not only how seriously Paul Ryan is taken in the mainstream media, but that he is held up as kind of the example of someone who thinks seriously about these things.
House intellectual.
There's a great piece by Jonathan Chait in The New Yorker, and we just had him on Counterspin talking about kind of the emperor having no clothes when it comes to Paul Ryan. But I think economic coverage in particular is so full of truisms and of kind of gospel thinking that doesn't really, you know, you can come away knowing less than you went in, because it relies on all kinds of things like tax cuts creating jobs, you know, and you think, well, wait a minute, how do tax cuts create jobs? But by that time, you're already, you know, the segment has already rolled past. So on economic coverage, I find more than almost anything else, I just can't just read the New York Times and Washington Post. I have to read Dean Baker, Beat the Press. I have to read some kind of alternative economic something. Otherwise, I just don't know which end is up.
One of the things that Fairness and Action Reporting Fair has done over the years is really monitored the way mainstream journalism, sort of punditocracy, has sort of lectured Democratic.
Service has issued severe thunderstorm watch number 258, effective until 9 p.m. This watch includes the following counties: Fenner, Illinois; Cass, DeWitt, Logan, Macon, Mason, Menard, Morgan, and Sangamon. Remember, a severe thunderstorm watch means that conditions are favorable for the development of severe weather, including large hail and damaging winds in and close to the watch area. While severe weather may not be imminent, persons should remain alert for rapidly changing weather conditions and listen for later statements and possible warnings. Stay tuned to NOAA Weather Radio, commercial radio and television outlets, or internet sources.
They're talking about Clinton moving the party to the center on trade. What are they talking about? They're talking about NAFTA, wildly unpopular at the time and in retrospect with people, and not just environmentalists and labor unions, but with regular workers. So here again, you have elite media sort of telling you what the political spectrum is, and their spectrum doesn't actually map on, not to my dream of what I would like, you know, the political landscape to look at. It's like, it's not that. It doesn't match onto the actual landscape. Just as we talk about the dread of leaving Afghanistan, when a majority of Americans would love us to leave Afghanistan, we talk about everyone's love for Clinton's position on trade, when in fact that was overwhelmingly unpopular as well.
Our guest, Janine Jackson. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. You know, in the last 20 years since you've been at Fairness and Action Reporting, since we've known each other, the great change in communication, the world historical change, of course, has been the Internet and digital communication. And I'm wondering, if you look back 20 years ago, what did you think originally the Internet might do? What were your questions? And then what do you think has actually happened? How has it really changed the type of work FAIR does? And how has it changed journalism in our society?
Well, you know, I my vision has partly come true, in the sense that I worried, as many people did, that it would, that the Internet would be overwhelmingly commercialized and that it would be mainly focused on buying and selling things rather than informing and letting us know about one another. At the same time, I've been really surprised and or pleased to the extent that that has happened as well. You know, so while I used to always get questions after I would talk about mainstream media, people would say, well, we don't have to care about the New York Times anymore because we've got the internet, right? And I think there was that hopefulness that somehow it would push aside and we would let the thousand flowers bloom and suddenly there'd be hundreds of news outlets that everyone would be reading every day, and that hasn't happened. But, you know, that's okay. People do have more options than they used to. And that's my overwhelming feeling, is that both for citizens who want to inform themselves and for those of us who want to see improvement in the big media, I see a lot of hopefulness and reason for hope.
At the same time, let me just follow up on this, because I think the question I'd want to know then is, when we're talking about something like coverage of Afghanistan or coverage of the economy, if you were just to look at the general news media coverage and really the material that most Americans get, it's hard for me to see how the internet's had any effect.
Yeah.
I mean, zero.
Exactly. And yet, the difference, I think, is only, you know, if FAIR's mission has always not been we never thought the New York Times would say, oh my God, I read this article in Extra and we've been doing it all wrong. You know, the idea was not so much changing them as changing us. And while I think it's absolutely true that many people still get the same crappy coverage of Afghanistan and as on many other issues as they used to, I think people know it more. And I think people who have a question or have questions have places to go with those questions that did not exist before, that are more accessible. So yes, you know, there's still the change that we need in the big media is a big change. But we do have informed citizens, and we do have citizens who now know how to challenge what they get in the newspaper and on the nightly news, and not just to have the questions, but to actually find some other outlets. And then once you find them, you know they're there. And then maybe eventually you do stop watching the nightly news and you do rely on this constellation of five or six other sources that you've assembled yourself. But we at FAIR always believed that there's no substitute for being an independently informed citizen. And the internet, for all its shortcomings, has helped people to do that.
Our guest, Janine Jackson. Let's go to the phone lines now to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes. As you're speaking about independent media, I've never heard you talk about like Link TV or Free Speech TV, which are independent stations.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. Janine, Link TV, Free Speech TV, maybe a little background on them for listeners who might not be familiar with them.
Well, they both are, and you would probably know their origin stories better than I, but they both are, not accessible everywhere, I guess dish stations that are available that do independent productions, a lot of foreign productions. In other words, Link TV in particular has a connection with Mosaic, which brings programs from the Middle East that you're not likely to see other places. The caller is absolutely right. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, have the purview that I have, which is focusing on corporate media and what's missing there, and only get to point to independent sources as kind of alternatives and other places to get counter-narratives, you know, and to find out what's missing and fill in those holes. But absolutely, folks should know about, you know, go all the way around the dial and see what's out there, and you'll find a range of things that, you know, that are worth holding on to, particularly for coverage that doesn't put the United States at the center of everything, which can be very helpful.
One of the areas that Fairness and Action Reporting, FAIR, has talked about and written about for two decades, really from the very beginning, as I recall, has been a critique of NPR and PBS, of public radio and television journalism. And in a nutshell, what is that critique?
Well, that they've never really become the independent, non-commercial alternative to commercial media that they were intended to be, and that therefore their reliance on corporations and on corporate funding has made them wind up looking at like a kind of higher quality and often better, but in the same ways, limited run, particularly of political and public affairs programming that we get in commercial media. So they really are, as much as they do get money from the government, they do get money from us, never have they really been insulated from the need to seek private funding, corporate funding, and they've never really been insulated from the need to fight for their congressional funding every year, which makes them kind of a political football. So public broadcasting is really an unrealized dream, as far as I'm concerned.
Let's talk about a couple of issues, the news media issues that are very important and that are very interesting, and where press coverage, I think, is going to be central. The first one is Social Security, which there's a strong desire in our political culture at the top to get rid of Social Security, to privatize it, to eliminate it, or certainly shrink it down and make it a less viable part of our society, not just in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party as well. And there are all sorts of ominous signs that the leaders of the Democratic Party are willing to trade on this issue if they can. On the other side of the coin, there is overwhelming evidence that the vast majority of Americans like it a lot and want to keep it. And it's sort of this very interesting balance going on. And how do you think the news media is handling this story?
Oh, I think it's about the worst story I can think of in terms of the way corporate media cover it. It's flat-out scaremongering. The idea that Social Security is going bankrupt, is going broke, is in a crisis, will not be able to pay out funds. This is all BS, you know. I mean, it simply isn't true. Even if you use the most pessimistic assumptions about economic growth, you know, the changes that would be needed to adjust Social Security to continue healthily going are the sort of changes that we make to programs all the time, you know. And I would again recommend Dean Baker at Center for Economic and Policy Research as the go-to guy on explaining why Social Security is not going broke. But frankly, any Paul Krugman, any progressive economist who hasn't totally bought the line on this will tell you that it simply isn't the case. There are people who would like it to be the case, but that doesn't make it true. And so to the extent that journalists talk about a day of reckoning coming forward, they really are guilty of Trudy Lieberman, also at Columbia Journalism Review, has just recently written a kind of look back at the way media have misled on Social Security. I would recommend that as well. And it really has distorted the public understanding, not just that people think they don't like Social Security, which they do, but that they also think that it won't be there for them. You know, that young people think they're more likely to be abducted by aliens than to receive Social Security. This is all nonsense, but it's effective, and it affects what sorts of policies people support. And I really, it's really a malfeasance on the part of journalists, the way they have told the Social Security story, I think.
Janine Jackson, our guest. And Janine, do me a favor, take your fair hat off for a second. And I want to ask you what your take is on President Obama and his what sort of job he's done in the Obama administration in general.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, what can I say? I'm somewhat of a skeptic, I would say not a cynic, and my hopes were not high, but I've been depressed as hell at the way this administration has gone. We're in more wars than ever. We had an opportunity to really reform health care, which people really wanted, and as someone who's had a recent hospital stay that cost tens of thousands of dollars, which I can't imagine how anyone could pay, I think squandering that opportunity was a tragedy. And so, you know, I feel terrible about it, and I'm not saying that doesn't make me pro-Republican. It makes me pro-deeper and broader change.
Well, what do people like you do in that situation? I mean, how do you deal with an environment where the choices you're going to have on the ballot and the choices you're going to hear about in the news media are basically Barack Obama or the Democrats of like that on one hand, and then the Republicans, and, you know, which is a version of the party that is, by all accounts, well to the right of anything in American history?
Well, you know, I've never...
Well, going back to the mid-19th century, I think we might have some competition back then.
Put it back in entire history. Yeah, you know, Bob, I've never found a comfortable fit for myself within mainstream electoral politics. It's always been a matter of one day a year, you know, buying into that system to the extent that is required, and the other days of the year working to change that system and its failure to really represent the people that I certainly see every day, very few of whom feel gung-ho about anyone in either party or feel really the kind of connection that you feel with leadership when you think that they're going to do anything at all for you. I see that at a local level. People know who might fix their pothole, but by the time you get up to the presidential level, I see an overwhelming disconnect. And so what I try to do is to work on projects and at a level where I can really feel connected, that I'm helping other people, that I'm, you know, doing some work informing people or helping something concrete go forward and change in terms of changing policy, in terms of changing laws. And you just take one step at a time, the same way people always have.
Now, not looking at the top of the political system and the people in power and contesting for power, but looking at the rest of the population, how do you think this country's changed in the last 20 years?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I see changes going in all directions, I guess. I guess the point that I will pick to comment on is that is the intelligence and awareness I see among young people. I've done a lot of work at looking at police practices of stop and frisk that unfairly target black and brown people here in New York City. And you have at the one time something that is such an outrageous kind of Jim Crow, unfair, racist reality that so separates people in this city. And it's so depressing on the one hand. And on the other hand, I see the youth activism involved in that that is so smart and critical and unafraid, and I see them bonding with and working with the Occupy activists who say, you know, we're talking about economic inequality. Well, this is an issue of economic inequality, and I see that common cause being built. And that, to me, I mean, you know, I was in college, too, and I was surrounded by a lot of smart people, but I didn't see the same kind of awareness that, you know, things really are really deeply wrong, and yet not reacting to that with despair, still reacting to that with, well, what can we do actively at our local level to push back against that, and who is with us who might look different from us or who might be carrying a different sign, but, you know, we actually do support one another's issues, and we actually should be working closer together. And seeing that among 16 and 17-year-olds can't help but make
the National Weather Service in Chicago has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for north central Ford County, northwestern Iroquois County, southwestern Kankakee County, east central Livingston County until 3 p.m. At 1:54 p.m., National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm capable of producing half-dollar size hail and damaging winds in excess of 60 miles an hour. This storm was located 7 miles southwest of Hersher, or 14 miles southeast of Dwight, and moving northeast at 10 miles per hour. Locations impacted include Hersher, Buckingham, and Union Hill.
Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, also WILL FM Urbana. We'd just like to bring you up to date on what's going on with weather this afternoon, and there is the possibility that we will have some severe weather this afternoon and tonight in central Illinois. First of all, as you just heard, we do have a severe thunderstorm warning that has been issued for north central Ford County, and that will be in effect until